ます。
Can we begin with salutation to the Buddha? Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Hey, good morning, everybody. Okay, we've been now in the last chapter of the book in the Buddha's words, and we're coming very close to the home stretch, you might say. We've been in the section on non-returning. The last passage that I did was on starting on page 398 on the four kinds of persons. And now we come to the passage on page 400, which explains, it's called Six Things That Partake of True Knowledge. I found this passage particularly interesting because it gives instructions to a young layperson on how to progress from the stage of apparently stream entry, to the stage of non-returning. So this takes place when the Buddha was dwelling in the city of Rajagaha, the capital of the state of Magadha. And then he had a lay follower whose name is Digavu, which means literally long life, but as we see, he will have a short life. So he's sick, afflicted, and gravely ill. And then his father, the lay follower Digavu, addresses his father and asks his father to go to the Buddha and ask the Buddha to come to see him, because both of them apparently are disciples of the Buddha. Okay, so the father takes the message to the Buddha, and the Buddha comes to see this young lay follower, Digavu. And when the Buddha sits down, then he expresses his wish that young Digavu will be getting better and recovering from his illness. But Digavu replies that he's not getting better, that his pains are increasing, and it seems that he doesn't really expect to get much better. And so the Buddha therefore gives him some instructions, sort of encouraging him to attain the stage of stream entry. And it's interesting here that even though it's said that the Buddha is supposed to have the ability to understand the minds of others, the faculties in the minds of others, and the attainments of others, but here apparently the Buddha is mistaken about the actual level of achievement of this young Digavu. Because the Buddha encourages Digavu, he says to him, you should train yourself thus. I will be one who has confirmed confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and who observes the moral virtues dear to the noble ones, unbroken, untorn, unblemished, unmuddled, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped, leading to concentration. It is in such a way that you should train yourself. So in other words, the Buddha is urging Digavu to strive to acquire the distinctive qualities of the stream enterer. The distinctive qualities, the defining qualities, are what are called the four factors of the stream enterer. And that is this unshaken confidence in Triple Gem, in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and the virtues dear to the noble ones. Okay, so now the Buddha gives this instruction to Digavu, but then Digavu replies, he says, Venerable Sir, as to these four factors of stream entry that have been taught by the Blessed One, by the Buddha, these things already exist in me, and I live in conformity with these things. For I already have confirmed confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and I observe the moral virtues dear to the noble ones. So in other words, Digavu is here saying to the Buddha, it's not necessary to give me this instruction, not necessary to urge me to become a stream mentor, because I already am a stream mentor. So at that point then the Buddha changes his instruction and says, therefore, Digavu, established upon these four factors of stream entry, you should develop further six things that partake of true knowledge. So now what the Buddha is doing is instructing his young disciple to practice six types of meditation, particularly insight meditation, in order to lead him on to the achievement of true knowledge, vichā, which would be the state of arhatship. So these are six kinds of contemplations to be practiced, six contemplations of insight to be practiced in order to develop his wisdom further to the point that it will eliminate all of the barriers, all ignorance, and culminate in full knowledge, true knowledge, the state of arhatship. So he says, here, Digavu, dwell contemplating impermanence in all formations, in all conditioned phenomena, sabbe sankhara. Dwell perceiving suffering or dukkha, the unsatisfactory nature in whatever is impermanent. Dwell perceiving non-self in whatever is dukkha, whatever is unsatisfactory. Okay, so these first three instructions are urging the contemplation of the three marks or three characteristics of existence. And we can see how here the three marks are presented in a sequential series. One begins with contemplating all sankharas, all conditioned formations as impermanent. Then one understands that whatever is impermanent, because it has rise and passing away, it's unsatisfactory or dukkha. And because it's unsatisfactory, one cannot identify with it as oneself, and one cannot cling to it as being I and mine. Then he urges him to perceive abandonment. Probably this is referring to the abandoning of all unwholesome mental states. Then perceiving viraga sanyi, this is, but I would translate as the fading away of all conditioned phenomena. This is a kind of development out of the idea of impermanence. Impermanence is the most general way of distinguishing this characteristic. But then when one turns to fading away, one is perceiving or focusing on the vanishing of whatever has arisen. That whatever comes into being passes away. And then perceiving cessation again seems to be an intensification of the contemplation of impermanence. This is Nirodha Sanyi. One sees that whatever has arisen, first it fades away or passes away, then one contemplates the fact that it's completely vanished, that it's gone, can never come back, so it's subject to cessation. Okay, and so the Buddha then says, it is in such a way that you should train yourself. But again, Digavu tells the Buddha, again, almost like he's correcting the Buddha, telling the Buddha, you don't have to instruct me to practice these six things, since I'm already practicing them. He says, as to these things, that six things that partake of true knowledge, these things exist in me, and I live in conformity with these things. For I dwell contemplating impermanence in all formations, and so on. I dwell perceiving fading away, perceiving abandoning, fading away, and cessation. And then Digavu says, this is what is on his mind, what is troubling him. He says that, I hope that after I expire, so he's expecting to die, my father, that is Jyotika, won't be distressed. Then his father speaks up and says, don't be concerned about this, dear Digavu. Just pay close attention to what the Blessed One is saying to you. Okay, then after this conversation, then the Buddha gets up and leaves, and then shortly afterwards, the lay follower Digavu passes away. Okay, then after Digavu passes away, then the monks hear about this, and they come to the Buddha, and they report this to the Buddha. And they ask the Buddha, what is his destination? Where has he been reborn? Then the Buddha says, the lay follower Digavu was wise. He practiced in accordance with the Dhamma and did not trouble me on account of the Dhamma. And then he declares, with the utter destruction of the five lower fetters, the lay follower Digavu has become one of spontaneous birth. This means that he's been reborn spontaneously, not through human parents. And when one speaks about spontaneous birth, it always refers, or almost always it refers, to rebirth in one of the higher celestial realms. In this case, probably it's in the pure abodes. So he says, the lay follower Digavu has become one of spontaneous births due to attain Nibbana, the final liberation there, without returning from that world. So this is the fixed way of describing the attainment of a non-returner. So this indicates that Digavu is now a non-returner. So here we have a lay disciple who has reached the penultimate stage of realization. And apparently he's just a young man since his father is still looking after him. We don't read about a wife and children surrounding him. And also I found this passage interesting because it points out the six contemplations that are to be undertaken by somebody who's already established in the stage of stream entry, the six contemplations that are to lead one further to the attainment of final knowledge, what's called true knowledge, the state of arhatship. And what is distinctive, I thought, about this passage is that sometimes the Buddha emphasizes for one who has attained the stage of stream entra, in order to go further to reach arhatship, he emphasizes developing first the jhana and then developing insight on the basis of the jhana. But here the Buddha doesn't speak about the jhanas at all. It's possible Digabu has already attained the jhanas, and so that's not necessary. But it's also possible that we could see the Buddha here giving Digabu instructions that lead through insight knowledge to the state of arhatship without requiring the prior attainment of a jhana. I'm not saying that this definitely supports that interpretation, but it's just a possibility. Okay, now we come to the next passage, which is the passage called Five Kinds of Non-Returners. Okay, so now the Buddha is speaking, and he's speaking about the seven factors of enlightenment. What are the seven factors of enlightenment? Anybody know them offhand? Okay. Yeah.
Investigation.
Yeah.
Concentration.
Not right away. Yeah. Concentration is there, but no. Anybody know the seven factors of enlightenment? Okay, there's mindfulness, investigation of phenomena. Energy, okay.
Tranquility?
Not yet.
No. Concentration yet?
Rapture.
Okay, rapture or piti, joy. What comes next?
Tranquility.
Okay, tranquility.
Concentration.
Right.
Equanimity,
right. Okay, so mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, energy, rapture or joy, tranquility, concentration, samadhi, and equanimity. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to explain seven fruits and benefits that come from developing the seven factors of enlightenment. Okay, the first is that one achieves arahatship early in this very life. And it seems that by early it means any time while one is leading the normal course of one's life. So if one doesn't attain final knowledge, it's arahatship, early in this life, then one attains final knowledge at the time of death. That is, just before death takes place, one is able to arouse one's insight knowledge, and then one can achieve arhatship. Okay, so those are two attainments of arhatship. But now comes the best passage on five types of non-returner. Okay, if one does not attain final knowledge in this very life or at the time of death, then with the utter destruction of the five lower fetters, one attains Nibbana in the interval. I'm not going to explain these terms now. First we'll go through the whole passage, then I'll explain them. But what are the five lower fetters? Okay, Sakkaya Ditti, or view of self, doubt. Oh, you're looking at the book, that's not fair. Say? Okay, I want to get them in order. First we have to get the three lower fetters. Okay, adhering to rules and observances. Four is what? We have view of self, the first one already. I thought I heard it back there.
Desire.
What kind of desire?
Sensual.
Okay, sensual desire. And then ill will. Okay, so putting them all together. View of self. Doubt. Clinging to rules and observances. Sensual desire. And ill will. Okay, so with the five, with the utter destruction of these five lower fetters, first is one attains Nibbana in the interval. Then if one doesn't attain this, then one attains Nibbana upon landing. If one doesn't attain Nibbana upon landing, then one attains Nibbana without volitional exertion. And if one doesn't attain this, then one attains Nibbana with volitional exertion. And if one doesn't attain this, then at the least one becomes one bound upstream, heading towards the Akhanita realm. Okay, these are five classes or five types of non-returner. And the exact meaning of them, it's a matter of different interpretations in the different early Buddha schools. Okay, now the first one, I think maybe it's good that I put the actual Pali word on the board. Actually, for all five of them. okay, I translated this, the first one, very literally. The word antara means in between. And parinibbāyi means one who attains nibbāna. Now, in the Pali commentaries, the commentaries of the Theravada school, this type of non-returner is understood to be one who achieves the state of liberation, who achieves arhatship after taking rebirth in one of the pure abodes, and then he achieves arhatship in the first half of the lifetime. And then the second one, which I translate literally, one who attains nibbana upon landing or upon striking or hitting, is said to be one who achieves arhatship after passing the halfway mark of the next life, after passing through half the lifespan as a non-returner, in the second half of the life, he achieves arhatship. Okay, and then the third is understood to be one who achieves arhatship without making a special intense exertion to achieve it, but just through the natural merits and strength and inherent strength of his spiritual faculties he's able to attain. Whereas the fourth is one who can only attain after making an intense effort, a strong effort. He's bound to reach the stage of arhatship because he's a non-returner, but in order to achieve it within that lifespan, he has to make a strong effort to attain. So that is what's meant by that volitional exertion. Okay, the fifth is called one who is going upstream, Udang Soto, heading towards the Akanita realm. The Akanita realm is the highest realm of the pure abodes, the fifth and highest of the pure abodes. And this is one who doesn't achieve arhatship in the next life after taking rebirth in the pure abodes. He doesn't achieve it in that life, but he'll go on from one life to the next in the pure abodes for several lives, finally taking rebirth in the highest pure abode, the Akanita realm, and then he achieves arhatship in that state of existence. Okay, so this is the way the five are explained in the Theravada commentaries. But I found that there's some problem with this interpretation. One problem is that if one reflects on it, one finds that it that there are not really five types of non-returner here, but the third and fourth types just become variants on the first and second types. So one has one who achieves arhatship in the first half of the life, one who achieves it in the second half of the life, and then those two just differ according to whether they have to make an exertion or whether they can achieve it without a strong exertion. So those two then don't become two different types, but just two variants that are applied to the first and second type. And yet there's another sutta that occurs in Anguttara Nikaya. This is in the Book of Sevens. It could be sutta number 51. So my memory of the number might be wrong, but it's called Purisangati Sutta, the destinations of the person, or a person's destinations. And that sutta uses a simile to illustrate the five kinds of non-returners. And according to that simile is of a spark which leaps off when somebody is striking, when a smith is striking a hot iron piece of metal. And then the spark leaps up, and one spark is said to go out while the chip that flew off from the piece of metal is still in the air, burning. It goes out while it's still in the air. The second type of non-returner is like the chip that's broken off from the piece of hot metal with the flaming chip. It goes up into the air and it hits the ground and goes out as soon as it hits the ground. The third one is like a flaming chip that breaks off from the metal, lands in a pile of grass and burns that grass a little bit for some distance, then goes out. The fourth one is like the chip that flies off, hits the pile of grass, and then continues to burn over some distance before it goes out. And then the fifth is like the chip that flies off, hits the ground, lands in some grass, then it sets off a trail of grass that leads to a pile of hay. And then the hay starts to burn, and it flares up and makes a little fire, which burns for some time and then goes out. So this shows that the five types of non-returners are set in a sequence. And so the way I've come to understand these five types of non-returner is in a way, first, that supports the idea that there is an intermediate stage between death and rebirth. And that intermediate stage is what comes to be called in the early Buddhist schools the Antara Bhava, a stage between two distinct existences in which somehow the stream of consciousness still exists. It's still capable of perception, reflection, thought, activity. And so the way I understand the first type of non-returner, it is a person who passes away as a non-returner, enters into that intermediate stage, and then before arriving back into a new existence, he achieves final liberation within that intermediate stage. And so the consciousness no more comes into rebirth, but it passes into final nibbana directly from the intermediate stage. And that seems to agree with the simile of the chip which flies up and breaks off from the block of metal, flies up flaming, and then goes out while it's in midair before it hits ground. The second non-returner, this is called Upahacha Parinibbai. Upahacha means having struck or having hit. And the idea seems to be, well, I translate it, having landed. And then this is compared to the chip of metal, the flaming chip, which breaks off, flies into the air, hits the ground, and then goes out right after it hits the ground. And so I understand this to be the case of a person who passes away as a non-returner, enters into the new existence, and then very soon after arriving in the new existence, because they're reborn spontaneously, so they don't have to undergo the slow process of development like a human child. So very soon after arriving in a new existence, they immediately already possess the five spiritual faculties, and then he'll reflect on his state, realize that he's a non-returner, and then immediately begin contemplation, and then very soon afterwards reach arhatship. The third would be somebody who is reborn in the new existence but doesn't achieve arhatship very soon after taking rebirth. But after taking rebirth, spend some time living in the new existence, developing contemplation, but without much effort, without strong determination, is able to reach arhatship, because that person's spiritual faculties are very sharp and powerful, because he has well-developed merits and paramis or spiritual perfections from the earlier life. So he's able to reach arhatship quickly and naturally without much effort. Whereas the fourth one is one probably who has to spend a longer time practicing diligently, making a strong effort, strong determination, and then is able to achieve arhatship. And then the fifth one is just the way I explained it, the way that's common to the Theravada tradition and other traditions. That is the one who doesn't achieve arhatship within that next life as a non-returner, but goes up within the pure abodes from one realm to another until reaching the akanita realm and then reaching final liberation there. Okay, at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions. Say it.
Kind of category.
Yes.
Arhat is Nibbana with or without residues. Applied in the pure abode.
Can the idea of Arhat or Nibbana without residue?
Yeah.
Apply in the pure abode.
Yeah.
The non-returners achieve arhatship in the pure abode. And then they continue to live out their lifespan in the pure abode as arahats.
So it's with residues.
So that's the... They live in the state of the nibbana with residue until they come to the end of their natural lifespan in the pure abode. Then they pass into the nibbana element without residue.
Until this non-returner have several or numerous lifetimes, because
is that the question?
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems that.
It's possible that this deer has numerous, endless, not endless. The number is limited, but not as limited as I saw it before, because
yeah.
He could go from one realm to another realm in the
Akanita. Yeah. This seems a little bit like So Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland, we have the once returner who can actually take two more lives. Actually, the once returner maybe has more lives even than two if he takes rebirth in pure removes. And then we have a non-returner who actually returns several times. But what's meant by a non-returner is that he doesn't return to this world. In other words, to the kama loka, the sensual world of existence. But it's said that they can take several rebirths in the pure abode, in the pure abodes.
And that is what is stated in the sutra, not in the commentary.
Well, that's definitely implied by this idea of the one who becomes bound upstream, heading towards the akanita realm. I think that's definitely implied. Though the suttas don't give much more than, you might call these formulaic expressions. I don't recall elaborations in the suttas on what actually happens, say, to the non-returner. It just said that he, according to this fixed formula, he becomes one of spontaneous birth who is due to attain Nibbana there, which without returning from that world. So all this means is that he doesn't come back to this world, either the human realm or more probably the sensual realm, the Kamaloka.
Thank you. My second question is there a subtle body in the intermediate state? Otherwise, how could the stream of consciousness exist?
Yeah, I understand that there is a subtle body there. My evidence for this is, doesn't come actually from Buddhist texts, but from accounts that I've read, not of people who achieve the state of non-returner, but this is people who have been reborn as human beings, and some of them have like recollection of their previous life, not through so much through meditation, but just to come spontaneously. And they've given reports which have been recorded and, you know, quite rigorously investigated cases. It's not like fantasy and imagination. But cases investigated by, there was a professor of medicine at the University of Virginia, Ian Stevenson, who recorded many of these cases. And what happens with a person, sometimes they are able to recollect their previous life, including their previous death, and almost invariably, no matter what country or culture they come from, whether it be from a Buddhist country, from India, sometimes from China, even from countries which don't accept, from cultures which don't accept the idea of rebirth. But what they report is that they recollect their consciousness separating from their physical body at death, and yet they see themselves still retaining their body, but it's a very light body, not made out of the coarse matter, and they're able to move about through the power of thought. They can move over long distances. And yet they still perceive themselves as having the same physical body that they did at death. And then they move around over the countryside, traveling to different places, until they find a particular couple to whom they're attracted. Then they attach themselves to that couple. And then when the couple has sexual relations, then they lose their clear consciousness. They feel that their consciousness is sucked into the womb of the woman. And then they lose the clear consciousness. And then the next time their full awareness comes to them is after they have been reborn. And so it seems from their reports that in this stage that takes place that after death, that they retain a kind of subtle body which is a replica of their previous physical body, and yet it's not encumbered by the limitations of dense physical matter. And so I would assume that the person in the intermediate stage who's a non-returner will also retain that physical body, that settled physical body.
And when Dika who says when he is worried that when he dies his father will be distressed, does that mean his dear has have affection?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, I'd like to ask a question. You discussed about six things that partake of true knowledge. And
right.
Toward the end, basically the three characteristics of existence, the blending of all defilement,
yep,
mental states, and then the last two kind of related, fading away of conditioned phenomena,
yep,
and perceived succession. Why is the fading away significant? Why not both arising and fading away? Why is the focus just on fading away?
Yeah, the way I understand it, and this is my own interpretation, this explanation isn't given in the text. With the contemplation of impermanence, one would be observing arising, change, and passing away. Arising, change, and passing away. But as the contemplation intensifies and becomes more finely focused, what stands out most distinctly is the stage of passing away. And so the attention will then become riveted on that stage of passing away. And that really intensifies or it accentuates the understanding of impermanence. Since one is now seeing how whatever arises passes away, passes away, passes away. And so one sees that everything is just slipping away.
I guess because we will attach things and really pass away.
Yeah.
And then another question I had, if there's no mentioning for the non-returners, I thought we had to what's the right word? And we have to abandon the other five titles, there's no mentioning of abandoning the higher titles, the attachment to existence, to non-existence.
It isn't mentioned in this passage. Oh no, it is mentioned. It says here, with the utter destruction of the five lower fetters. It's mentioned.
I thought the five lower fetters are view of self, doubt.
Those are the three lowest fetters. The view of self, doubt, clinging to rules and observances. Those are the three lowest fetters. And so he's actually already eliminated these with the attainment of stream entry. But then what he does, has to accomplish beyond that, is to eliminate sensual desire and ill will. And so sometimes all the five fetters are grouped together just to show what the non-returner has eliminated. But in his case, he's eliminated the first three at the stage of stream entry. And then as he passed from stream entry to non-returner, he eliminated the other two fetters.
But then to go from non-returner to balance, you have to just destroy another five fetters. Right?
Yeah. But they're not mentioned so often in the text. Usually when one passes to arahatship, it just explains it as the destruction of the asavas.
Thank you.
Questions? There's one question from the internet. At the time of the Buddha's birth, was he already a non-returner? If the Buddha was a non-returner, he couldn't have come to the human birth. Or was he a stream enterer? Of course, nothing is said in the text about him being either a stream enterer or not a stream enterer, but I'd say that since nothing is said about him being a stream enterer, it's very unlikely that he was a stream enterer. It seems that at the time of his birth, he was not established in any of these four stages of realization, because his enlightenment was something that he had to discover all by himself. If he was already a stream enterer, then he would have already had that ripe understanding that blossoms in full enlightenment. And so he wouldn't have had to struggle and strive and investigate and explore and sometimes head down blind alleys in order to find the way to enlightenment. He would have already known the Eightfold Path and just would have had just to follow that path to the end. So it seems to me that at the time of his birth, he was not established in any of these stages. Okay, take the microphone.
But according to Buddhism, is there a time limit for this antarbhava?
Okay, first let me say that this idea of an antarbhava is not accepted by all Buddha schools. The Buddha schools differed even over the question whether they'll accept the antarbhava or not. The Theravada school itself, as expressed in the Pali commentaries, doesn't accept the idea of the antarbhava. But I found some suttas which seem to me, and I'm not alone in this, some other scholars have also discovered this, that there are some suttas which suggest the idea that there is a state between existences. O-H-D-A-V-J-Sekara, do you know his name? He was professor of Pali and Buddha studies at University of Peradeniya in maybe 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. Very prominent Pali and Sanskrit scholar. He wrote a very influential paper, a very important paper called The Concept of Gandhava in the Early Buddhist Texts. And he held that the idea of the Gandhava, which is used in Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 38, is indicating the being in the intermediate state. And he found a number of suttas that support the idea of the intermediate state. Okay, so the time limit, it seems that there's no real time frame given in the texts themselves. In some Buddhist traditions, it's, it's said that they use a time frame of 49 days, that's seven, because it's 7 weeks, 7 by 7 seems to be an auspicious number. I think both the Chinese tradition, is that true, Chinese tradition? Tibetan tradition has the 49 days of the Bardo state. But I think this is just a convenient number. Maybe it has, it's considered to be auspicious because it's 7 squared. But from what I could say that probably there's no fixed number, because the reason why, this is my understanding, why is there this intermediate state generally? Because if somebody is coming back to a human rebirth, the consciousness has to wait, so to speak, until the proper karmic conditions have come together, till there's the right couple, the right environment, the right social circumstances, till a particular group of people karmically connected are all present. And so only when all of these conditions obtain is the consciousness able to come back for the rebirth. So that amount of time until the right couple comes together, all the right conditions come together, could be very variable. It might vary from maybe a few days after death to a few weeks to even a few years. Like sometimes there are reports about famous Tibetan lamas who pass away, and then like the Dalai Lama or some other lamas. And sometimes it's like from the time the old Lama passed away till the time that his reincarnation was born, could be several years in between. And the same is true of these ordinary people who have rebirth memories. Several years between their death and their rebirth.
Thank you.
And for what, could you repeat the name of the professor?
Who wrote?
The paper Pasek Vrindavan.
Oh.
His name
is Vijay Sekara. His book, a collection of his papers, is published by Motilal Banasidas. It's called either Buddhist and Vedic Studies or Vedic and Buddhist Studies. I believe I refer to it in the notes to the Samyutta Nikaya. Another book is Peter Harvey, The Selfless Mind. He has some discussion of this point. And then he brings in a number of texts from the Nikayas that support the idea of the intermediate stage. Peter Harvey, H-A-R-V-E-Y. The selfless mind. Okay, I want to go on now to the next section. So now we've been going progressively through the different stages of realization. We've gone from the stream enterer, then we skip the once returner because nothing very much is said about the once returner, except that it's he comes back more than one time. Then to the non-returner, and now we come to the arhat. And then I took as the first section, or first selection in this section, a passage which is intended to show the difference in point of view, way of understanding, or mental constitution between the monk who is still, or the person who is still a trainee, one who has gained the insight into the Dhamma, who has gained at least the first stage of attainment, but has not yet achieved arhatship. The difference between this person and the mental constitution of the arhat. Okay, so this sutta takes place as a kind of dialogue between a monk named Kemaka and a group of other monks who apparently don't have a clear understanding of this point. Okay, so the sutta opens when this monk Kemaka is sick, afflicted, gravely ill. And then a number of elder monks send one of, apparently a younger monk, on a message to go to Kemaka and say to him, "We hope you are getting better, we hope your pains are subsiding, we hope you're feeling better or stronger," and so on. And Venerable Kemaka replies, "I'm not getting better, my pains are increasing, my strength is diminishing," and so on. Okay, so then the messenger returns to the elder monks and gives reports on Kemaka's condition. Then the elder monks say, "Come, friend Dasaka, approach the monk Kemaka and say to him, 'The elders say to you, friend Kemaka, these five aggregates subject to clinging,'" that's the Panchupadana Khanda, "have been spoken of by the Blessed One," that is form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. "Does the Venerable Kemaka regard anything as a self or as belonging to a self among these five aggregates subject to clinging?" In other words, they're asking Kemaka, whether he still has Sakkaya Ditti, identity view, in regard to the five aggregates. Okay, so the messenger, the monk Dasaka, goes to Kaimuka, presents the question, and then the Venerable Kaimuka replies. He says, these are the five aggregates. I do not regard among these five aggregates subject to clinging, I do not regard anything as a self or as belonging to a self. So he's completely free of the view of self with regard to the five aggregates. Okay, so now the monk Dasaka takes Kaimuka's answer and goes back to the elder monks and reports it to them. And so then the elder monks say to the monk Dasaka, they say, then go back to Kaimuka and say to him, if the Venerable Kaimuka does not regard anything among these five aggregates as a self or as belonging to a self, then he is an arahant, one whose taints are destroyed. What do you think about the statement of these five, of the, this group of monks? Is it accurate? Okay, let's see what happens. Okay, so then the monk Dasaka takes the message, goes back to the five, to the group of monks. Oh, I'm sorry, the monk Dasaka takes the statement of the monks and goes to the Venerable Kaimuka and reports to him. And then the Venerable Kaimuka replies, these five aggregates subject to clinging have been spoken of by the Buddha. I do not regard anything among these five aggregates as a self or as belonging to a self. Yet, I am not an arahant, one whose taints are destroyed. Doesn't this seem paradoxical? Why not? Suppose I'm one of those monks and I come here and I ask you, isn't he an arhat, one whose taints are destroyed? Some of you shake your heads like this, but now I ask, why not?
So only one of the taints, not all five.
And there's one underlying I.
It's only Sakkaya.
Okay, that's the good answer. That it's only Sakkaya Ditti or the view of self that's been destroyed. Okay, so let's see what Venerable Kaimuka replies. So he says, friends, the notion I am has not yet vanished in me in relation to these five aggregates subject to clinging, but I do not regard anything among them as this I am. So this means that even one who is a stream enterer, or according to the commentary, Kaimuka was actually a non-returner. So even the non-returner, whether stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, they have eliminated the view of a self. So they will not regard anything among the five aggregates as being I am. They don't identify anything of the five aggregates as this is what I am. But still the idea, I am, or in Pali it's simpler, it's just the word asmi, which means like the English word am, but it implies I am, still occurs to them. It occurs spontaneously or naturally. But when the idea I am occurs to them, they recognize that this is a deception or a delusion, and so they will not take the idea I am as indicating a reality, and then go on to identify one or another of the five aggregates as being that I. Okay, so then the monk Dasaka goes back to the elder monks and reports what Venerable Kemaka has said to them. So then they say to Dasaka, go back to the monk Kemaka and say to him, the elders say to you, friend Kemaka, when you speak of this I am, what is it that you speak of as I am? Are you speaking of form as I am, or do you speak of I am as existing apart from form? Do you speak of feeling, or perception, or volitional formations, as, or consciousness as I am? Or do you speak of I am as apart from consciousness? When you speak of this I am, what is it that you speak of as I am? Okay, so Dasaka, you can see he's already broken out into a sweat, and he's panting and maybe asking for a glass of water, but still he must be a young monk, so he has to obey his elders. So he says, yes, friends. Then he might have to walk up a high hill or maybe a couple of miles to see Venerable Kemaka. But he says, yes, sirs. And then he goes back to deliver his message. And at this point, even though Kemaka is sick and in pain and weak, but he must see that Dasaka is getting worn out on the verge of collapsing. So he says, finally he says, enough, friend Dasaka, why do you keep running back and forth? Bring me my walking stick and I'll go to the elder monks myself. Okay, so he gets his walking stick, and maybe he climbs down the hill, and probably in that part of India, I remember in Sri Lanka, some of these hills are very steep with sharp rocks, and so you have to walk down and up very carefully to be sure that one doesn't trip on the rocks. Or it could be walking a few miles through along a forest path, but he's still leaning on his stick, he's walking, he meets the elder monks. And then the monks repeat their question to him. When you speak of this I am, what is it that you speak of as I am? And then Kemaka replies, I do not speak of form as I am, nor do I speak of I am as something apart from form. I do not speak of feeling or of perception or of volitional formations or of consciousness as I am, nor do I speak of I am apart from consciousness. And then he says, friends, although the notion I am has not yet vanished in me in relation to these five aggregates, the idea I am still arises in him, still occurs within him, and it hovers around the five aggregates as though the five aggregates were a self. So it's as though the five aggregates are calling out to him and saying, we are yourself. But he recognizes that the five aggregates are not the self, because he's already seen this with wisdom. And so he says, even though the idea I am has not yet vanished in me in relation to these five aggregates subject to clinging, still I do not regard anything among them as this I am. Okay, then he gives a simile. I'm not so sure that the simile is very good, but I'll relate it anyway. He says, suppose, friend, there is the scent of a blue, red, or white lotus. Would one be speaking rightly if one would say the scent belongs to the petals or the scent belongs to the stalk, or the scent belongs to the pistils. And then they say, no, friend. And then he says, how would one explain rightly? And they say, answering rightly, one would answer, the scent belongs to the flower. I say the simile might not be very good because there's probably one part of the flower which actually produces the scent. It's not the flower as a whole that produces the scent. But conventionally speaking, we would say that the scent belongs to the flower. So if we recognize the limitations in any simile, then we could say that the simile is applicable. Okay, so we say that the scent doesn't belong to the petals, to the stem, to the stalk, or to the pistils, but the scent belongs to the whole flower. And so, he says, I don't speak of form as I am, feeling, reception, volitional formations, or consciousness as I am, and yet the idea I am has not yet vanished in me in relation to the five aggregates subject to clinging, and yet I do not regard anything among them as this I am. Now we have to stop the class at 11 o'clock because they have to do the offering ceremony at 11 today. But we still have about 10 minutes. Okay, so now Kaimuka says, even, this is where he explains the key point, even though a noble disciple has abandoned the five lower fetters, and that includes the fetter of identity view, the view of a self existing among the five aggregates, still in relation to the five aggregates subject to clinging, there lingers in him a residual conceit I am, a desire I am, an underlying tendency I am that has not yet been uprooted. And so what is remaining even in the non-returner is the conceit I am, it's a residue or some trace of asmimana, that is the conceit I am, or a desire I am, a desire to have some kind of self-existence. And it's also called the underlying tendency to this idea or thought I am. That has not yet been removed or uprooted. But sometime later, he dwells contemplating rise and fall in the five aggregates subject to clinging, such as form, such as origin, such as passing away, such as feeling, perception, volitions, consciousness, such their origin, such their passing away, And as he dwells thus, contemplating rise and fall and the five aggregates subject to clinging, the residual conceit I am, the desire I am, the underlying tendency I am, that had not yet been uprooted, this comes to be uprooted. Then he gives what I would call now an excellent simile, a very applicable simile. He says, suppose there is a cloth which has been soiled and stained, and then its owners give it to a laundryman. The laundryman would scour it with cleaning salt, lye, cow dung. In those days they didn't have soap or soap powders, so this is what they used for cleaning in ancient India. Then he rinses it in clean water. And so the cloth becomes pure and clean. All of the stains of the grease and grime have been removed from it. But it still retains a residual smell of the cleaning salt, lye, or cow dung, which has not yet disappeared. The laundryman then gives it back to the owners, and the owners put it in a sweet-scented chest, and then that residual smell of the cleaning substances vanishes and is gone. And so too, Kaimukha says, even though a noble disciple has abandoned the five lower fetters, he still has this residual conceit I am, desire I am, underlying tendency I am, which has not yet been uprooted, but then he contemplates the five aggregates subject to clinging, and as he does so, that residual conceit, desire, underlying tendency, I am, this vanishes and disappears. Okay, then at this point, the other monks, express their gratitude to Venerable Kaima for explaining this point. Then they delight in his statement. And while this explanation was being given, it said, the minds of 60 elder monks and the Venerable Kaimukha were liberated from the taints by non-clinging. That is, while Venerable Kaimukha was giving that explanation, all of them achieved arhatship. I think I'll have to stop the exposition at this point, because now they want to do the ceremony, the offering ceremony here. We could have a shorter question and answer session. There's no other room that we could go to. Yeah, maybe it's nice outside. So we could just have some questions and answers outside. Yeah, I don't want to do what's... Oh, I could also bring this, so it would get recorded. No, but then it won't be recorded on video. And so there are other people outside who would like to watch the videos. Okay, so we'll just do the sharing of the merits. Then we could go outside under the tables, under the trees, and then do some questions, if there are questions. Okay, so let us end by sharing the merits. I'll do it in the shorter way today. I feel a little bit under pressure. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika panyanta nanumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam chiram rakantu desanam chiram rakantu mangparam eta vata cha amhehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabbe devanumodantu, Sabbe bhutanumo dantu, sabbe satanumo dantu, sabba sampati siddhya. Bhava upadhaya vichihe tato etantare satakaya upapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibutin. Okay, so we will have a class next week, that's September 26th. I hope to finish the book next time. Wait, and then on October 3rd, what I'm going to do is have a comprehensive review, going through, summarizing the whole book, and then open to any questions on anything in the book. And then October 10th, there won't be a class. I will be away, actually coming back from California that day. Then October 17th, then we'll start a new class. That will be a class on the Majjhima Nikaya. I'm going to send a folder to Kaiti here for an announcement, and then she can send it to everybody in the class and put it on the website, which will give the program for that class. So 30 seconds.